Good morning. I am live, which means the tweet goes out and the coffee comes on. So, g'day, wherever you are. I've got a lot of stuff on my list today. There's some absolute zingers in there as well. So, things I really, really want to delve into in a little bit more detail today. The Grindr one in particular. We will talk about Grindr. We will talk about Scott's Grindr account. We will talk about how some people are unhappy that Scott might have had a Grindr account. It got political. Anyway, we'll touch on that, be that as strange as it is. So, starting in the normal place that I would start today around sponsorship, it is Varonis again this week. Security FWD, a brand new Varonis YouTube show from Varonis. Watch episode one about how far Wi-Fi can travel. Varonis is one of these companies I've had a really long relationship with, which has been fantastic. A company I did spend a lot of time with in different spots around the world, but now I just seem to be spending some time with remotely, which of course is where we are all at with this whole thing. So big thanks to Varonis for their ongoing support. They've also been a sponsor for many years as well. So I really appreciate them helping me do what I do, particularly now when I really don't have the choice to go anywhere else. Speaking of sponsorships as well, I tweeted the other day, said I have got some spots coming up in November. I tend to sort of just wait until there's a gap about a month out before I tweet anything. So if you work for a company that would like to appear on troyhunt.com in the sponsor bar, then send me a DM and we will get that going. But I'm sure I'll fill those out now that I'm actually devoting a little bit of time to it. So on to other things. Actually, on the conference things, while I'm talking about that, it is NDC Sydney. Very, very soon. When is NDC Sydney? Is it next week? I think it's next week. So, of course, NDC Sydney is, it is next week. NDC Sydney is NDC because there's like, there's no, well, there is a Sydney, but nothing is happening in person in Sydney, just the same way as it didn't in Melbourne or Porto or Copenhagen or Oslo or London or any of the other places that I would have been this year. I will not actually be in NDC Sydney this year, not either in Sydney or on the show, because there's something Charlotte spends a great deal of her time organizing. So she's currently lining people up from that. There's going to be a bunch of other people there, but my schedule has just frankly been a little bit too nutty lately. So I'm taking a little bit of the pressure off by not speaking NDC Sydney this year, but there'll be a heap of other people there. So I'll put a link into the notes for that as well. But that is, Jesus, Friday. So it starts Monday. Wow, okay. All right, so NDC Sydney, coming to you all over the world from Monday. Now, a few other things before I get into the larger things. And I do see my comments here as well. Juan, hey, Troy, do you use HomePod to control your smart home while at home? I'll tell you what, I'll answer that in the IoT bit because I'm about to do the IoT bit, and then we can talk about what a freaking mess IoT is. In my order of things on the list and per the photo in this teaser image for the live stream, I did have a first hit with the GoPro Black 9 Hero. I think I got all those words the right way around the other day. Now, again, I got this to do work, honestly, and I will be doing some live updates from other places outside of the office because this does get repetitive. If not for you, then at least for me. But I gave this a run on the jet ski the other day, and the quality was pretty epic. So it can record in 5K. I don't know for how long because it's got a 32 gig memory card in it. But what I found super, super awesome is I took this footage, and if you haven't seen it, go look at my tweets from a few days ago. It's in there. Just go to the Troy Hunt, the media bit. So it was pretty awesome in terms of, number one, the stability of it. So I'm like blasting along the jet ski at the speed limit, maybe. And this thing sitting on the front of the jet ski, pointing backwards at me, and you can sort of see the beach along the side, and the beach maintains really, really steady levels whilst I'm like bumping up and down and all over the place. And the way it actually does it, when you set it up, it takes only parts of the frame. So imagine, I'm looking at the video now, imagine like this is your full frame. It goes, no, we're actually going to come in a little bit like this. And then digitally, it is able to then move that frame around because it's got buffer on all the sides. Which is pretty cool. And if you want to take out the image stabilization, you can actually get a wider angle on the lens. But the image stabilization was really, really cool. And then I got to a bit and just started like doing donuts because first of all, I'm a man child. And second of all, because it's a lot slower, and then you get a whole bunch of water spraying up. And I just took one still from the video and I put that in the tweet thread. And it was super, super cool just how good a still from a 5K video is. In fact, it was quite amazing. So I'm pretty happy with that. Now, keep in mind, I'm coming from the GoPro I had before that was a Hero 4, and this is a 9. So we're like five more generations in. And in fact, when I got this one, it's like, do I have to get the big plastic case to like watertight the whole thing before I use it? And it's like, no, because it's all built in now. So you used to have like a big transparent case and you'd put the camera inside of that every time you wanted to get wet. Don't have to do that now. But I did get one of the big floaty container things so that if it goes flying off the jet ski at some point, at least it floats and doesn't sink. But anyway, super impressed with that. Burton's seen the footage. He thinks it was amazing. Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool, mate. So I will get more of that. I've got lots of ideas of things that I want to do with it. In fact, just looking at the kit I bought, it comes with a handle. So there is a handle here which I can use when I'm like out on the wakeboard park or something like that, which is a place I'm very tempted to be this afternoon. Heading for 29 degrees Celsius here today, which will be the hottest day we have had so far this season before we start getting into the proper hot days. So I think some water time might be good. Scott's back. Scott, we're going to talk about Scott. And Lars is there. Well, okay. All my good mates are here. Nice. Now, someone asked about IoT and about did we call it AirPods? What did Juan call it? HomePods. And in fact, this is good that Scott and Lars are here because both of them are going through both the pain and the joy of IoT at the moment as well. So my progress this week is I had my friendly Sparky, who is an electrician, around a couple of days ago, and we put about 9 Shellys in different parts of the house. So there's a lot of switches now that have a Shelly behind them. Now, the value proposition of this is that I can now create automations on switches where there is a Shelly. So, for example, one of the automations I've got, I'm just going to pull open my Visual Studio Code here. I've got a scene where it's a sunset scene, and it turns on a little like nightlight outside the kids' room. It turns on a light behind a mirror in the entertainment room, turns on a light in the hallway, turns on a light near my fireplace, turns on a light above the fireplace, turns on the light in the pool, turns on the light in the garden at the back, turns on the lights at the front, which is pretty cool. So it's like it just hits sunset and boom, all these things come on, which is really, really neat. And then there's another scene, which is bedtime, which just turns them all off. And then I can trigger that however I wish. I can trigger that by going to the Home Assistant app. I can trigger that by integrating it into HomeKit. I've got to get all my homes right, which you could then control from a HomePod. I can also integrate it into Alexa and control it from an Echo somewhere in the house. So that is pretty cool. The thing I'm mucking around with at the moment is, and first of all, I'll tell you what, like this was fun. I had to go out to the electrician, put 9 Shellys in the house, and then I come back. And it's like, okay, so which one's which? So you go through the pairing process and it's like, hey, we've found Shelly 127858. What would you like to call it? So I don't know. What does it do? So you have to sort of call it like foo and then switch it and then keep walking around the house trying to figure out what the hell it's actually connected to. So I eventually got all that done. The issue that I'm having now is the nomenclature around what kind of switch it is. So in my perfect world, the Shelly sits behind a physical switch. Every time you change the position of the physical switch, it changes the state of whatever the power supply was. So regardless of whether the switch is up or down, if the light is on and you hit the switch, it goes off. If the light is off and you hit the switch, it goes on. Now, the challenge then is what kind of switch is it? So when I have a look at my Shelly app here, we have different button types, as they call it. Now, by default, your button type is a toggle switch. Now, a toggle switch sets the Shelly relay to be on or off, and it acts as a flip switch with a state for on or off. So it's always either on or off. Now, what I think I want to do with these, and I've got this like working better than as a toggle switch, is set it as an edge switch. And an edge switch sets the Shelly device to change the state on every hit. So every time you hit either a switch or a digital switch, so a physical switch or a digital switch, it changes the state, reverses the state. So This is where I think I want to be, because I got to the point the other day where Charlotte said, why can't I turn the lights off? She was literally hitting a light switch. It's like, I'm used to using light switches. Every time I hit the switch, like the light goes off. And I ended up having to turn everything off digitally because I don't know. And in fact, one of the Shelleys got into a really weird kind of, almost like it wasn't fully bricked, but like partially bricked state where I just could not turn a light switch off. So I literally had to go to the switchboard and kill a master switch to the lights, and that eventually reset everything. So this is not without its pain. I am progressing on the blog series about navigating through the pain though. And that is something which I'm just like literally trying to find time to do, but I have this 5-part series building up at the moment, which will hopefully explain most of the questions people have. So to go back to Juan's question, do you use HomePod to control your smart home while at home? HomePod's the Apple one, right? So I do have an Apple TV 4K, which can act as a hub for HomeKit. I use some things on HomeKit. So, for example, I've got the little HomeKit icon on my watch. I hit that, and there's a little thing here to be able to open and close the garage door. If I'm riding my bike home like I did this morning with the kids, so we went for a ride, had some breakfast, and I'm riding home, and I'm just like, hey, the name that I cannot mention on air, open the garage door, and then the garage door opened, and that was magic. So, yes, you can use that, but then there are also times where I want to use Amazon or Alexa or Echo, whatever we want to call it. You know what I mean? Because that's what the kids have in their room. They've got like a little tiny Amazon Echo Dot in their rooms because then they can control lights and things like that. And one part of this blog series is how do we get the different parts of the ecosystem to play nice together? Because forget about trying to do everything with one. Like it's just never going to happen for all sorts of various reasons. So yes, it works nicely, but it has to work nice with the other things as well. All right. So I'm just looking at some of my other comments here. So Scott says he's going to make a good IoT company and be a gazillionaire. I reckon if you could do that, you would be a gazillionaire because it is such a mess. And I said like very early on, I wish like Apple would buy Home Assistant and do it in a user-friendly way. I think as I'm progressing through this, I'm sort of increasingly conscious that you're just never going to be able to get the power that you need out of an IoT system and be consumer-friendly as well. You're going to have to be people like us that are happy debugging some stuff and sitting there writing YAML and hacking away at things. It's just I cannot see another way to do it short of any industry unifying standard. And the closest we're going to get to that is someone will come along with a standard and there'll just be one more standard than all the ones that we already have. Now, having said that, as part of this process as well, I did go through and put a whole bunch more of the little motion sensors. In fact, I've got one of the Xiaomi Akira motion sensors just here, put them in different places. So now at least I'm toggling lights on stairs and things like that. This one's a little bit sticky because I put it under my monitor like this. So just in front of me. And I thought, oh, that's good because then it won't be on the table obstructing anything. And one of the things I've realized is that these don't work very well when they're upside down. When they're upright, they work fine. When they're upside down, not so much. So maybe I just need to put like some double-sided tape on the top of it and then you put that under the monitor. I'm very, very tempted to do that. Things you learn along the way. Someone's here has just ordered a Shelly plug yesterday. Can't wait to play around with the REST API. Yeah, and they do have REST APIs. So both the joy and the horror of the Shellys is every single one of them is a web server. So I can, in fact, I was looking at this on my laptop because I've been doing a lot of this on laptops so I can actually walk around the house and do stuff. But if I bring the mic over here, if I look at one of my tabs over here, I can literally go to like 192.168.0.250/settings and I get a JSON response of all of the settings of this particular Shelly. Or if I don't go to /settings and I just go to the root of that IP, then I get a full web interface where I can do pretty much everything that you can do on the phone as well. And then you can hit RESTful APIs. And Shelly's got some pretty good documentation on that. Shelly is really developer friendly from what I've seen. There's also message queues, which you can use on the devices, which is kind of cool. So there's a lot you can do with them. I think the trick remains just playing nice with typical human interface devices, such as light switches. So a good example of this is I had originally said to the electrician, because I had a heap of Shelly's anyway, it's like, let's put Shelly's behind the light switches, which are turning the IoT lights on or off in the kids' bedrooms. So the kids have got these in each of their rooms. They've got half a dozen LED downlights, the same as I've got here, that can do RGB because kids like neon. Now, I was going to say I'd never do that, and then I looked up and, oh, yeah, shit. I would never do that in my bedroom personally. But I think it's kind of cool for kid rooms. That the challenge is, though, is that if the cleaners come in and then they turn off the light switch and then the lights in the roof go off, now they have no power. And if they have no power, you cannot then turn them on digitally. So I thought, oh, I'll just put a Shelly in the wall. Then at least if someone turns the light switch off, then I can digitally, via an automation or something, turn the power back on. And then if the lights themselves aren't on, then I can turn each of the lights on too. But you just get into this really, really weird, messy cycle where it's like, which thing should I be turning off and in which order? And then what if someone turns the switch off and then I can't change the state of the lights? So I've got to turn the switch back on digitally, but maybe I don't want the lights on. I just want to change the color. So then your head kind of explodes. So I'm working through that. I ended up putting a Shelly in one room, one of the kids' rooms, and not in the other kids' room. And I'll see if I can find a nice happy ground for that. Okay, other things here. So Scott's had to figure all this out for his garage door. I think Scott and I are both pretty sorted on garage doors at the moment. We still need to do that. That's cyber broken on IoT, mate. We should actually line that up. In fact, maybe just throw Lars in as well with his llama cam. That could be fun. Real thing, Google it. Question here, can the Shelly be used with a push button switch? Clipsal makes a mech that fits normal wallpaper. Yes, they can. In fact, that's what I'm using for the downlights in my media room where we have the TV and also the lights behind the mirror. In fact, if you go back through my various tweet threads, you'll see that I've used Clipsal push buttons. In fact, they're called Saturn Zen is the model. And the reason I wanted to use the push buttons is that were I to design this house from scratch, and this house is probably a 30-year-old house that got really heavily renovated probably 13 years ago, and then I moved in 5 years ago, and I've inherited all of the design decisions. But had I a clean slate, and as I'm renovating rooms, what I'm doing is moving to push button, because the joy of push button is that there is no physical state in terms of, you don't look at a wall and go, oh, yes, that switch is up, so it's off versus down, so it's on. Because if you do that and then digitally you change the state, I think just the human interaction of it gets kind of screwy, because humans are very good at kind of recognizing patterns. And then if you digitally inverse the pattern from what the physical state is, I think that kind of messes with your head. So the push buttons are really great because they always look the same. Now, yes, you can absolutely positively do that with the Shelly. In fact, that's the one, or the two rather, light switches in my house that are working precisely the way I want them to. So no problems at all with that. Okay, other questions here. I just got to scroll through Lars and Scott's crap and Stefan's crap. You know, Stefan from Iceland. This is the nice thing about being home. At least you get people from everywhere. Yeah, that's something, I guess. Other questions in here. IP254. So Frederick's saying, you actually have maxed out a subnet, or have you put all the Shellys in the upper side of the IP range? I'm just letting Ubiquiti allocate IP addresses as it sees fit. I'm not quite sure how it cycles them by default, but what I do know is that I have well less than 100 devices in total on my Ubiquiti setup. So I am well under half the allocatable IP addresses for that subnet. So I'm a long, long, long way away from having problems with IP address exhaustion at the moment. So that's not a problem. All right, moving on. Data breaches. So this is an interesting one. Chaobus. This is a really, really weird data breach. So here's what happened. Normally, when there's been a data breach, someone will send me an email and they'll say it'll be an email or DM or something. And they'll go, hey, such and such a company's had a data breach. Here is the data, or here is a link to some chatter about it or something like that. And earlier this week, I had like half a dozen people all do this at once, which says to me, all right, well, something has happened that is very, very visible. Now, Chaobus, let me actually quote properly what they do, because Chaobus is not a Not a name that I was familiar with. I think it's very US-centric. Best Asian Food Delivered. Get the Best Asian Food Delivery app now. Discover and order delicious and authentic Asian food. Simple and easy. Chow Bus. Now, it asks for a phone number and it puts a plus one in there by default, so I assume this is a very America-centric thing. Anyway, what seems to have happened is that someone has dumped their entire customer database. They've hosted it as a CSV somewhere. They've then emailed the entire customer database, and I saw some commentary saying that the email did come from a Chowbus domain and it was signed correctly and all the rest of it, and they've just linked through to the CSV. So there were 800,000 records, just over 800,000 records, 444,000 unique email addresses. And I think it was one of these cases where every time you order, you get a row. So on average, people have ordered almost twice each. And this is why so many people saw it at once. So it was a really weird thing. And it always makes me sort of wonder about the motive, right? Like, what is the motive for just emailing hundreds of thousands of people in one go and sending them all the data? The data had only just been obtained. This wasn't something that dated back some time. So it's not like, well, they had a period where they monetized it and now the value of that has dropped to just about nothing. So they're like, YOLO, just spread it. So I wonder if it was malice. I wonder if it was disgruntled insider. I wonder if someone didn't like the food delivery one day and managed to find a vulnerability somewhere and just dumped all the data. But it was a very, very odd kind of thing to see happen. And it's not often I see odd things these days because I kind of feel like I've seen so much of it now. Okay, other things. Now let's start to get into the shadier side of things. I'm just going to answer one other question I've just seen here first. So Stefan said, what's the bandwidth usage for so many IoT devices? Now, there's an interesting thing here. I haven't tweeted this yet because I wanted to delve into a little bit more, but I'll talk about it now since you've asked. I don't think the bandwidth usage is very much at all. Now, to be clear also, a large part of the value proposition of Home Assistant is that it is a very self-contained unit. The idea is that that sits here, runs in a Raspberry Pi in my case, sits in my server rack, and devices inside the house talk to that. If there is no internet, the house still works. This is the plan. Now, when I go to my Pi hole, and for those of you that have not seen the Pi hole before, Google either my name or Scott's name in Pi Hole and you'll find the things we've written about it, but it's basically a DNS resolver that can black hole ads and things like that. The number one requested domain in Pi Hole by a significant margin is api.shelly.cloud. So the last 24 hours, there have been 28,309 DNS queries for api.shelly.cloud. Number two is a Tuya address. Now, Tuya is the manufacturer of a lot of the LED lights I have. Now, what's interesting is if I delve down into this Shelly domain and see the IPs that are hitting it, it's loading. Even though I've got like a dozen Shellys here, it's only the one IP address that keeps hitting the Shelly cloud. Now, I think I know why this is. I'm just going to pull up my Ubiquiti dashboard and check which Shelly it is that is running on the IP address that ends in .87, and I'll have a look. But one of the things that I notice with this is one DNS request pretty much every second. So every 1 second, the same Shelly device is making a DNS request. It's obviously not caching the DNS request, at least not for any longer than a second. I don't know how long it's actually checking that domain. Now, if I go down to .87, 87 is the garage door. Now, the garage door is the one which I've enabled MQTT on because I'm actually pushing message queues to it to open or close the garage door. And it's the one that cloud integration is disabled on, which makes me wonder why it's making so many queries to the cloud. Now, the reason why the cloud, and let me just take a step back and explain the cloud integration. Shelly's very proposition is that you can control the Shelly by the power of the cloud. And what that means is that when you join the Shelly to your network and you get an IP address and give it a name, configure it and everything, it can communicate out to the Shelly cloud such that you can send commands to the Shelly cloud and the unit can then receive that command. And this might be the 1 second situation here. It's just polling, looking for new commands. so that you can do all this via cloud. Now, because I don't need to do it via cloud, because I've got Home Assistant sitting in here locally, for most of the devices, I've explicitly disabled that. For the one on the garage door, as soon as I enabled MQTT, it said we need to disable cloud in order to do that. So I need to go back and look at why that particular one is making so many requests to the cloud, because that is curious. Scott, so much DNS. Scott, have you put HTTPS in your dashboard yet? Good question, mate. You got any other questions? I tell you, I'll do it in my spare time. How about that? I want to do it. The problem is every time I want to do something like that, it's not just the one thing. It's a rabbit hole of other things, because I want to do the blog post on it and I want to do a few associated things, because there's things like Synology NAS. There's obviously the DNS stuff with the pie hole. When you said your dashboard, I think you meant my Home Assistant, but maybe you meant pie hole. Yeah, I got to do both of them. So anyway, we'll come back to that. That's definitely on that to-do list as well. So loads and loads of DNS queries. Looking at the blocked domains, most of the blocked domains are not IoT things. In fact, the number one blocked domain, and the pie hole is just reloading here, but I know from previous inspections of this, is a telemetry address for Microsoft that Outlook uses. So Outlook seems to just be really, really greedy. So here it is. So with 20,140 hits, browser.pipe.aria.microsoft.com. Now that's over 20,000 hits. The next most popular domain is only 3,500, and that's an MSN domain. And then after that, it's Dropbox and then Apple. So those get black-holed. Inevitably, it's just telemetry is not being used for anything. Looking at the ones which are the top 10 permitted domains, here's all the IoT ones. So there's Shelly.cloud, there's Tuya, there's myharmony.com. So I've got a Logitech Harmony remote control. There's a Hue, Meet Hue Diagnostics at meethue.com. And there's also a NanoLeaf one. So of those top 10 domains, a lot of them are the IoT ones. Now, as part of the series I'm doing, I am doing a bit around the security piece as well. So, yes. All right, moving on. I got a thing I promised I'd talk about this week because someone sent me an email, which I thought was interesting from a discussion perspective, and I did a tweet thread on it, and then they sent me a follow-up email, and I said I'd answer the question in my video because I think it's an easier thing just to discuss verbally than to try and cram it into a tweet. So here's the... here's the TLDR, and I'm not going to mention the guy's name for reasons that will become obvious. There's a guy who liked to look at porn on the internet. I know, shock, horror. and this was about 10 years ago. And in more recent times, he's decided maybe that wasn't such a good idea and effectively wants to scrub himself from the internet. Now, the tweet thread here, I just quoted some of what he said. He said, all I ever did at these sites was create fake accounts with fake emails that I opened and discarded the same day. All right, the guy's in a little bit of OPSEC here. But he goes on. He says, I was stupid enough to use the same password for my real life accounts and for these shady accounts. It's generic, but my whole family knows it's my password. So obviously what he's worried about here is people joining the dots. So what if someone got access to one of his online accounts, porn accounts, and saw the password and then correlated that with his real life password that people know. Now there's a point in here as well about IP addresses. So the tweet that I've issued here, as I said, these sites often store IP addresses, not just for the last logon, but also the one used at registration as well. So now he's stressed that even with fake email addresses, someone could correlate both his password and IP and decloak his, porn habit. Maybe he's got a port habit as well, who knows. Anyway, he had a porn habit. So he tries to have his data deleted from porn sites. I contacted one of the cam sites I was a member of back in 2012. I could not completely remember my profile, but they advised that they never delete old accounts, just freeze. So anyway, I put this thread here and the TLDR, the last tweet here in the thread, as I said, the moral of the story is you need to think ahead about what accounts and browsing habits you want to keep private, not just now, but in the future. That applies to email address choice, password choice, and obviously using a VPN as well. You can't go back and change this stuff later on. And I think the interesting observation, and then I'm going to talk about his follow-up email I promised to touch on, is that the privacy discussion. So there is a discussion about what things you want to keep private now. So for argument's sake, let's say that I was suffering from depression. As far as I know, I'm not, but so I was, and I wanted to go and spend time on depression websites, depression forums, things like that. And I would be very conscious now that that is not something that I want to share with other people. So I could imagine that that would be a case where I would be thinking about privacy right now. But then there might be other things I do where I really don't care about the privacy of it right now, but then fast forward into the future and that might be something that changes, but then I can't go back and like erase myself from the internet. So anyway, here's the bit that I said I'd cover in this week and try and address. Coffee first. So, and I'm going to deliberately leave some of it out as well. But I'll give you the gist of it. He says, do you know with the new GDPR rules why companies that would appear to be subject to the rules are not following them? And if this will eventually be something they have to answer for. So he gave an example of one particular porn site, holds data on all accounts from the beginning of time. They recently took over another company and hold data on members from 2009. That have not logged in since then. So keeping data from more than a decade ago. They say they never delete accounts. Would this not violate the retention standards? He's then given an example of another site, the guy has been busy, who has suffered through two breaches, also advised they never delete inactive accounts. They have quote, so many returning members. What a joke. Do the CCPA, which is California's rules, rules cause them to have to perhaps change this stance. Many of us want to move on from our association with sites like this, fair enough, and trying to remember usernames and burner emails from 10 years ago is impossible. Is there no pressure on these companies or ramifications or not employing a reasonable retention period for inactive accounts? Even Ashley Madison has now changed their rules based on following Canadian recommendations. And basically, why won't these companies just get banhammered by GDPR, CCPA, And other countries do have privacy laws as well. It's one of the things to recognize. GDPR and CCPA are popular acronyms. There are other parts of the world that have privacy laws as well, including Australia. They're not very good here, but we do have some privacy laws and data breach notification laws. So a few things here. First thing is, I think, and all right, I'm not in his shoes, but I think that this is being unnecessarily concerned. And the reason I say that is, let's break into two parts. The likelihood of someone being able to correlate him as an individual to accounts that were set up with burner emails a decade ago is extremely low. Someone, first of all, has to consciously want to do that. So they have to consciously want to go out and say, I want to try and find this bloke in such and such a website. They're going to need data from that website. Now, if it's Ashley Madison, you have data. If it's Adult Friend Finder, you have data because there are data breaches. But it's a non-trivial thing. Now, I don't know, maybe his wife is some database guru or something like this, but most people out there would not be in a position to take that data and actually go through and figure out whether the person used the service or not. If you do that, if it's the password you're worried about, a lot of the passwords in these services are stored as, in the case of something like Ashley Madison, bcrypt hashes. Now, Ashley Madison had other problems with the way they stored passwords, but many times now they are strong cryptographic hashes. So you're going to have to go through a cracking exercise. With the IP addresses, IP addresses are very often dynamic. There are cases where they are static, or they were static for long enough that you could possibly correlate them to other activity from the person, but then you've got to go and find that other activity as well. And if it's a decade ago, there's a very, very high likelihood that that IP address is not going to be the same as the one today, not least of which because maybe you signed up from a mobile device, or maybe you signed up from a different ISP, or maybe your IP was dynamic and it's changed. And I guess my point is that, number one, there's a lot of different dots to join. Number two, I guess it's a question, and this is a really personal thing, right? I guess it's a question of how much that would matter. So some of the examples he gave are porn sites where you look at porn. I know it sounds self-explanatory, but I would imagine that that matters less to most people than, say, Ashley Madison, which was there to actually have affairs. Like, that was the business model, still is the business model, as far as I know, of the organization. And I guess the point I'm getting at here is that in the realm of like shady, dodgy things, I can think of much worse things, but that is a very personal thing, and I respect the fact that the guy's a bit worried about it. Now, in terms of privacy laws in different countries, the challenge here is actually enforcing them, and particularly at the moment when people do kind of have other things on their mind, how likely you are to get that enforced. GDPR is the one that comes up very, very frequently, and I'll give you a bit of feedback that I've had from people that have tried to go down the GDPR route when they have been unhappy with their company's data handling practices. I've got notifications literally from data protection authorities that have been passed on by people that lodge complaints, where they've said the company in question is based in the US. They're outside our jurisdiction. Bringing a case against them would be extremely hard. And yes, I know GDPR is meant to extend to any organizations and other places handling the data of European data subjects, and that's an admirable goal, but the ability for them to enforce that, particularly if it's not like a multinational like Facebook or something like that, is extremely hard. And the thing that I always lament with this attitude, the fact that we can have a law in one place and then say it extends to people in other places, is imagine it's China. Now, I don't have a good grasp on what China's privacy laws are, but I would say that they are quite different to the ones that are here and in the UK and Europe and the US. Now, how would we feel if China said, look, anyone who is from China gets the protection of our laws? So let's say it's someone from China who's using Ashley Madison, and China has a view on what the laws are, and they say, look, Ashley Madison, you got to follow it. So, well, we're a Canadian-based company. We're on the internet. People come and use our service. That doesn't mean that we've got to apply all their laws. And even if you think we should, like, what is your recourse? What is your ability to actually enforce that? So the ability to enforce it is a difficult thing. Now, having said that, when these organizations are European-based or where they have European footprints, at least there is some leverage which can be applied. If it is a Facebook, it's like, well, you actually do a lot of business in Europe. Would you like to keep doing that business? When it's organizations with physical presences, that's a different thing as well. But the ability for an organization, and in fact, one of the examples I had was a data aggregator in the US. So I got a data aggregator in the US, had a Belgian guy's data, and he sent me on the feedback from the Belgian DPA. In fact, I'll tell you exactly what they said. Why not? Because I don't know if I'm ever going to finish this blog post. I started putting a blog post together about the difficulty of enforcing privacy laws across borders. And when I say that, it sounds super boring, doesn't it? Let's have a look. I'll tell you exactly what they said. He had to translate it for me. The working title of this blog post is Lessons from an American Data Aggregator Breach in a GDPR Era. And the response here from the regulator, this was actually about Apollo. So I was in the Apollo data breach as well. Regulator in Belgium says, it is not directly clear in which country Apollo is headquartered and if there is an office in Europe. In the latter case, then the privacy authority of that country is the lead in the story. In this case, it seems like the company is based in the United States, San Francisco, that would limit a process from Europe severely. The purpose of a breach is, in the first place, you change your password so your company account can no longer be accessed with the old one. So basically the DPA in Belgium has gone, it's too hard, change your password. And when you think about it, like, that's the reality of it. There is so much data out there. There's so many incidents, and governments are stretched so thin. I think the chance of a regulator actually being able to clamp down, particularly on an organization outside of their direct jurisdiction, is extremely slim. All right, so I'm just going to pause there and have a look at some of the comments that are coming here. Scott's talking about plausible deniability. We'll talk about his plausible deniability and Grindr in just a moment. What else we got here? A lot of chatter. Dustin says, I'd be less worried about future individuals with personal relationships to me than about future governments with armed, heavily surveilled control over myself. I mean, this, we just, if nothing else, 2020 has shown we just don't know what the world will be like in the future. So coming back to the privacy side of things, it's like, once we give away privacy, you can't get it back. And I don't want to sound like a tinfoil hat person here, because I think as far as security people go on privacy, I'm probably a lot more liberal than most are. But the way I think about a lot of these privacy things is we tend to think very much around privacy as, what are the things that I need to keep to myself now? For example, the depression example. Okay, I want to keep that to myself now. Everything else, kind of fair game, and that we won't take additional measures to protect it. And it almost feels like we need to kind of invert that and say, what are the things that I would be willing to share now? And then I won't take any measures over that, and then everything else I will protect. Now, look, I don't consistently do this myself, so I'm not trying to get up my pulpit here. But that is an interesting way of thinking about it, right? So as opposed to saying, what do I want to keep private, what do I actually want to share? Other comments here. All right. Let's get on to Scott and his Grindr account. No, actually, there's something worse even first. I'll get to you, Scott. Don't you worry, mate. Now, this is a friend of Scott's and mine, Ken Munro. Now, Scott knows where this is going already. This wasn't meant to be like the adult version of the weekly update, but there is a bit of a theme running here. Let me just read Ken's title here. So Ken runs a company called Pentest Partners in the UK. He's a good mate of Scott's and mine. Ken and I did the kids smart tracking watch thing last year. And he's done many, many other wonderful things. He's a great bloke, great speaker too. He's got a really good TED talk and a bunch of other really noteworthy speaking things. Now, Ken's title here is Smart Male Chastity Lock Cock-Up. Not a typo. I got to read you the TLDRs, and then we'll just talk about the wisdom of this. So his TLDR, he's got some nice bullet points here. Smart Bluetooth Male Chastity Lock designed for user to give remote control to a trusted third party using mobile app API. Now, I'm not going to explain exactly what a chastity lock is if you're not familiar with it already. But let's just say it does lock in someone's chastity being the premise of abstaining from sexual activity. Second bullet point, multiple API flaws meant that anyone could remotely lock all devices and prevent users from releasing themselves. Now, again, there's a male chastity lock, so it has to prevent the male from having sexual activity. I'm trying to do this seriously. Point three, removal then requires an angle grinder or similar used in close proximity to delicate and sensitive areas. So where we're at is that you've got this digital IoT device attached to your equipment to maintain chastity, and it can be remotely locked, and you may need an angle grinder to remove it. Next bullet point, precise user location data also leaked by API, including personal information and private chats. Vendor initially responsive, then missed three remediation deadlines they set themselves over a six-month period. Then finally refused to interact any further, even though majority of issues were resolved in migration to V2 API, yet API V1 inexcusably left available. This post published in coordination with Internet of Dongs. Also a real account. In fact, a guy I've spoken to in the past. Nice guy. So the details of this is that it's insecure direct object reference, which incidentally is exactly the same vulnerability that Ken found within the kid's smartwatch, the one that we did the story on last year, which incidentally is effectively the same thing that Scott and I covered with the Nissan Leaf vulnerability several years ago, where I could actually control bits and pieces of Scott's car. And insecure direct object references usually are literally, can you count? Yes, you can hack, because there is a number in a URL and you change the number and you get access to something that you're not meant to. And this is just insanely crazy. Now, with this story, as with the next one on Grindr that we'll talk about in a moment, it's because it's Twitter and there's a bunch of people that just want to lose their mind, it's very easy for this thing to go off on the wrong tangent. Now, Ken was super, super clear through all of this that none of this is any sort of ethical or moral judgment as to whether or not you want to use a chastity lock. Look, it's not my thing, but if it's your thing, good on you, have fun. I don't really care. I'm interested in the security side of things. But I did see the discussion start to go off, and I think the word that I saw used many times was kink shaming. Ken's not doing that. He doesn't care. Maybe Ken likes the lock. Who knows? I hate the fact that we can't just keep focus on the core issue. And the core issue here is that a very personal device, whether you're into it or not into it, I think we could all admit it's a very personal device, and then private chats and things like this were put at risk just due to super, super, super sloppy design. Did not see that one coming in my timeline, did I? Don't make jokes over what I just said either. Now, I'm reading the comments here. Dustin, is it for males only, or will fathers be getting these for their teenage daughters? It doesn't work on the daughter. And that I think the only way I can explain this in a live stream, which I did flag as suitable for kids, is Ken had to use a carrot to demonstrate the lock. Use your imagination. Adam says, hi, this is the lockpicking lawyer. And today I would love to see the lockpicking lawyer do this. Now, if you haven't seen the lockpicking lawyer, super, super popular guy. He's got several million followers on YouTube. It's amazing how quickly he breaks through locks, like physical locks. I was watching one just last night where he's like, here is a really cheap Chinese padlock. I'm going to open it with a lighter. So he has a lighter and he's like literally just blasting the lighter at the keyhole, and he puts like a little torque wrench in the lock, and the lighter just melts the plastic inside the lock, because for some reason they put plastic inside the lock, which is like a sleeve around the barrel of the lock. It just melts the plastic, opens it up. I would be really interested to see his take on this, but I think Ken might have probably just covered a lot of it here anyway, because he has shown, should you find yourself in the situation where the lock is unable to be removed by yourself, he has shown how to remove it without an angle grinder, which is interesting. Okay, what else have we got in here? So for people listening to the audio and not able to read the comments, I'll just quote Scott, because I think this is a very, very fair anatomical explanation. It's for people with a penis and testicles, as it needs both to lock on. Things you didn't expect to hear today. All right, so here's a video for you of an appendage getting stuck in the lock. I'm not clicking that lock, Scott. I love that lock, that link. Let's move on to Scott. We'll talk about Grindr and Scott's Grindr account. Now, again, this is one of these ones that was actually a very serious issue. And in fact, I think it was handled well once we got to the right people as well. But it's also one where the discussion went off in the wrong direction on several occasions, frankly, because people like being idiots on Twitter and online, and I'll explain why. Let's talk about the mechanics of it first, because that's the important bit. Now, Grindr, for those of you that are not already familiar with Grindr, let's just start with their definition of what Grindr is, and then we'll talk about what I suspect is the colloquial understanding of what Grindr actually is. So Grindr, that's Grindr without an E, is the world's largest social networking app for gay, bi, trans, and queer people. Now, Grindr is, my understanding of Grindr beforehand, my understanding of it, and that's frankly only been reinforced from my experience with it, is that it's very much a hookup app for gay men. I think that was probably an accurate representation of the vast majority of use cases. Now, as with the chastity lock, that's fine. That's not my thing. That's other people's things. Good on them. Go for it. They should have privacy whilst they use this. Now, the problem with it is someone reached out to me, must have been about 2 weeks ago now, because I did talk about this very briefly in my weekly update last week, but I couldn't talk about the details yet. Someone reached out and said, look, I've found a really bad vulnerability in it, and I've been trying to get in touch with Grindr, and I can't get a response. Now, I get a lot of these emails, and it's people who've found things that aren't serious vulnerabilities. But this one did sound interesting, so I said, look, can you give me a little bit of detail? And if it's bad enough, I'll try and find someone. So the guy sent me back something very, very simple. Now, there's a guy called Wasim. Wasim was happy to be named in this piece. He has done the right thing from top to bottom. So no problems with Wasim there. And basically what he found is, so, you know, password reset, right? So you've forgotten your password. So you go to a password reset page. You put in your email address. You go reset. You then get an email to that address. And that email has a link in it. Ideally, it is a time-limited one-time password. It is a secret. It should be a key which is not enumerable in any fashion. Can't be guessed, can't be brute forced, anything like that. So a nice strong key. And you click on the link and it passes that in a GET request, and the key's there somewhere in a query string, and then you set the new password. And the entire security posture of this depends on you keeping the link secret. This is why it's sent to your email address and to no one else. And what Wasim found is that when you go to the password reset page and you enter the email address and you click on the submit button, it makes an async callback. So it hits an API, and there's obviously a request to an API somewhere. Response comes back client side, and then the UX of the browser updates and says, thank you, we've sent the link. So it looks fine. unless you know how to press F12, because if you can press F12, all hell breaks loose, because you jump into the developer tools, you go to the network request, and you see that the reset password API returns in the JSON response the reset token, which is the secret which is meant to be sent to the email address. Now, it is sent to the email address. It works as desired. But you're getting the secret back in the response from the web app as an anonymous person. So we needed to demonstrate this. When I read his details, it was clear he was articulate. He had a good explanation for this. It didn't sound like he was fabricating anything. I wanted to test this. I did not want to test it with anyone without their permission. So I asked Scott if he had a Grindr account, which I thought was a reasonable question. He said, lol. Now, later on, I think someone was upset that Scott said lol at the premise of him having a Grindr account. Now, Scott is married to a woman. I've met her. She's real. I thought that was a reasonable response from Scott to lol at the premise of him maybe having an account on, what was the right terminology, the world's largest networking app for gay, bi, trans, and queer people. So that lol was contextual and it was relevant. So I asked him to create one. I asked him to create one. He set it up with a test email address. I went through, followed this process, and I got into Scott's account. And it was that simple. Now, once I could verify this, I did actually reach out for a contact at Grindr, which is the tweet that I put out before last week's weekly update. And then I spoke about it a bit during the weekly update. And I did get in touch with someone senior at Grindr, and they did fix this very, very quickly once they knew about it. Now, let me finish talking about the mechanics of it, and then we'll talk about where everything just went off the line, off the wire, off the wire. Ah, went stupid. They obviously had a triaging problem. So the fact that Wasim did make genuine attempts to report this, and I've got screenshots of his attempts, he absolutely did the right thing with this. He went through the correct channels. He did actually get the vulnerability in front of people, and he got a response which was half-assed and dismissive. And Grindr know that they've stuffed that up. Now, they did genuinely have in their roadmap a bug bounty program. Now, I've seen several people say, well, of course they would say that now that they've been exposed. I'm confident they did actually have that planned. Grindr has gone through some changes. So Grindr actually got acquired by a Chinese company a couple of years ago. It was later deemed to be a risk to national security that a Chinese company owns Grindr. And when you think about it, that there's such a large platform with information which could be very personally damaging to people with accounts in there, I can kind of see how there'd be concern about a nation state who may be adversarial having access to that information. And of course, if it's owned by a Chinese company, it is owned by a Chinese nation state. So anyway, it had to come back. So it had to come back out of Chinese control. That transition backwards and forwards obviously has taken a lot of effort from people. And as part of that process, they have been looking at things like bug bounties. So I have no doubt that that was genuinely on their roadmap, and the timing was just really unfortunate for when Wasim reported it. So they fixed it up very, very quickly. They communicated very well. I think everything that they did once we got through to the right people was good. Now, here's where Scott got into trouble. In fact, I think it was very funny that Scott got into more trouble than I did, and then I got into trouble. So when when I got into Scott's account, again, with his permission, I changed his photo. And I was like, okay, so this is a dating site. I will pick like the sexiest photo of Scott I have. And that feels uncomfortable even just saying it. But there was a photo that I took of Scott. It's still here in my favorites. And yes, I understand that sounds weird as well, but I pull the photo out the whole time and use it as, God, I should be doing this over beer. Use this for occasions where we joke around a bit. And if I go through to this photo of Scott, now I'm going to put it up here on the live stream camera as well, but it is there in the blog post. It is this one. He looks particularly sexy in this photo. This was taken on the 19th of June last year. I think, mate, we were in Oslo then. I think we might have been on the boat cruise. We were. The boat cruise for NDC in Oslo. We were drinking beer. We were all mucking around. Now, this at no time was intended to be anything other, to the best of my recollection, other than a cheeky photo. He may well look like this when he does spend time with Mrs. Scott, as far as I know. Now, some people got very upset because they said he looks gay. Now, I don't even know where to begin with what's wrong with saying that. The fact that to the best of my knowledge, he isn't. The fact that that applies that stereotype to that photo, or the fact that they think that I chose this because that looks more like what a stereotypical gay person's meant to. They've just had a serious freaking vulnerability. Like, this should be the focus of the discussion, not Scott putting his finger in his mouth being sexy Scott. And again, it feels awkward saying this. But Scott, help me out here. Like, this just feels like people on the internet bored wanting to complain. I ended up getting to the point where I did boot someone out of the comments because it just kept going round and round and round. It's like, look, you are reading something into this that is not there. I hear your perception. I disagree with it. Let's move on and start talking about the serious security stuff. There are other places to go and talk about not liking Scott, for example. Go to Twitter and talk about that. But I just lamented the fact that, and as Scott said here in the comments, finding issues where none exist and we have no real issues to solve. And it was the same sort of people that were jumping up and down and getting upset with Ken about kink shaming because he reported the fact there was a vulnerability in an adult device. It's just like, honestly, get a life. This is just, it goes so far off tangent so quickly. And to be clear as well, I don't think it ever would if this was an in-person discussion. I don't think the couple of people that were upset there would have actually behaved in that way were we face-to-face and they saw the intent behind it. Anyway, that's that. So I'm just going to go and have a look at some of the comments in here. About the Grindr stuff. Look, that Grindr vulnerability, I just don't think I've seen something quite like that before. Like, that was crazy. Dustin, recent research study also found lots of underage users of Grindr not seeking or finding predators, but asking questions of older guys. Research said it was beneficial for them. So let's talk about Scott's and my experiences on Grindr for a moment. How long did it take, mate, before we were getting asked for pics? Now, I will use us collectively because obviously we use this account to demonstrate a purpose. The account has now been deleted, by the way. You cannot go and find Sexy Scott on there anymore. But immediately, it wasn't like, you know, hi, I see you're into like long walks along the beach kind of thing. It wasn't that kind of relationship stuff. It was very, very sexualized, very, very quickly. And I'm partly saying this because it speaks to the severity of the vulnerability too. Very sexualized very quickly. It turned adversarial very, very quickly. And to be clear, neither Scott nor I ever engaged in conversation with anyone either. Also, Scott's account literally says test account. Like, there was never any ambiguity that this was a test account because it said test account. But very quickly, guys were jumping online there asking for very intimate pictures in a very, very aggressive way. Now, again, looking at this in the objective way, imagine that sort of behavior is visible to people who are not meant to have access to those accounts. That could be enormously damaging, which again sort of speaks to, I can see where they would be worried about national security as well. What other comments do we have on here? So someone here said, people hearing Chinese company server and fearing blackmails amuses me. More likely data will be used to predict trends, market, political choices, stuff that will rarely be traced back to the data. I don't want to go back to this privacy discussion where we just don't know how to be used. It could be used those ways. It could be used for blackmail as well. It could be used for all sorts of leverage purposes. It could be used for profiling people. We don't quite know. And, you know, when we think about thinking back to the guy before who was worried about his adult accounts, if we think about the fact that he really wasn't concerned about that a decade ago, but how different was the world a decade ago? And then how different will it be in a decade from now? And if a country who we are worried about national security with did have access to all that information, could that potentially be a problem? And I think the answer is definitely yes. It could actually be a serious problem. Dustin says, pretty sure China has all my data, fingerprints and everything. Well, they have my fingerprints because I've been to China and I had to give them to them multiple times. Every time I went to China, I had to give them fingerprints. But then again, the Americans have my fingerprints too because I have to give them to the Americans when I go in there. So, yeah, they're all over the place. All right, so that's it. One more thing, and I'm conscious this has gone on for a bit, but last thing, Canadian government is now on Have I Been Pwned? So they are now the 11th government. I have almost filled out the Five Eyes. I just need New Zealand. If you're from New Zealand, get the NZ government on there and we will have Five Eyes covered. But Five Eyes does imply a little bit more spying than what this is. This is just simply access to Canadian government domains, which means that their cyber acronymed place, which is different to all the other cyber acronymed places. So this is the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity. The Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity now has the ability to query all of the Canadian federal government domain names, which is great. So that if any of their departments have appeared in breaches, they can find out. They get free access. We don't have anything formal in place. It's like, here's the keys. You know, you can go and query just that data. So there are controls to whitelist it to just their domain, so they can't go and query the New Zealanders' domains or things like that. So very happy to have them on. I hope that we see many others come on board in the future. We do have places like Australia, the UK, the US, Iceland, if Stefan's still there, Norway, if some of the Norwegians are still there. Many of these governments as well, when I did have the ability to travel, I went and sat down with and spent time face-to-face, such as the Norwegians back in December, which was great. All right. Looking at some of the last comments here, Jonathan, what about this idea, an independent third-party audited pen test-type padlock displayed in the browser? I think I'll just leave Scott to explain all the reasons why that's just never going to work. Scott, go for it. If people are worried about online safety, then don't have an online social media account. Just like if you don't want to be eaten by a shark, don't be in the water. I don't want to be eaten by a shark, but I'm in the water all the time. Not eaten yet. I also don't want to be hit by a car. I drive the car all the time. It is a much more nuanced thing than that. It's not something where the absolutes really make much sense in either way. All right, on that note, I'm going to tune out and hopefully go and get myself some wakeboard park time today and go and do some other cyber-related things as well. So thanks very much for watching. I've gone over an hour now, which is a long one, but there was a lot of stuff. It wasn't intended to be highly sexualized. It's just that all of these things lined up at the same time. But anyway, I thought they were interesting. Hope you did too. See ya.